Welcome to Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. Some members of the American public are receiving COVID-19 vaccines today. In fact, in Tampa, Florida's first vaccine recipient got theirs about an hour ago or a little less. Rafael Martinez delivered the vaccination to Vanessa Arroyo. Vanessa Arroyo is a frontline nurse, and this happened at Tampa General Hospital maybe about 40 minutes ago or so. So there are people now in Florida getting the COVID-19 vaccine, the first of what might be many vaccines. The vaccine from Pfizer received emergency approval late on Friday, and it began shipping 180,000 vials to distribution sites across the country yesterday. Two of those distribution sites are in the Tampa Bay area. Tampa General Hospital, which is where the first vaccination occurred this morning, and also the Pinellas County Department of Health is going to get vaccines. Florida is prioritizing residents and staff of long-term care facilities like nursing homes. We're going to hear from the director of the Pinellas County Department of Health and from a Tampa General Hospital doctor about the distribution of the vaccine. Then later in the show, we'll also hear from Congressmember Charlie Crist. We'll find out why he's upset about the Florida Department of Law Enforcement raid. There, I said it, raid, on the home of Rebecca Jones. As you heard last hour and you've been hearing for months now, she's the state's fired COVID-19 dashboard data scientist. Later on in the show, we'll take your calls. Here's the number to join the conversation. It's 813-239-9663. You can email dj@wmnf.org or you can text 813-433-0885. On Thursday, the Florida Department of Health director in Pinellas County announced what to expect in Pinellas. Pinellas and Broward counties are part of a pilot program for the vaccine. Dr. Yuli Cho says he expects to begin vaccinations for nursing home residents and staff. We're going to hear from him in a minute. And then in just a few minutes, we'll be joined live by a Tampa General Hospital doctor. So here is the Florida Department of Health in Pinellas County's director, Dr. Yuli Cho.
We're receiving over 21,000 doses. Pinellas County does have a large vulnerable population given our age, given the number of long-term care facility beds. And unfortunately, 67% of deaths here in Pinellas County have come from these long-term care facilities. We're hopeful that the vaccine will stem that tide and make some positive progress in curtailing this pandemic. The Department of Health in Pinellas County is partnering with paramedics and the Florida National Guard to administer the vaccines. The initial wave, we are going to be targeting nursing home residents and staff. The Health Department will provide coordination and other support on this particular mission. Keep in mind that participation in this pilot program is voluntary. This is not a mandate for the vaccines, and again, geared towards initially the nursing home residents as well as healthcare workers. As you're all aware, on December 10th, the FDA Advisory Committee recommended that the agency grant emergency use authorization to the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. We do expect that approval from the FDA will be coming and will be imminent. They did conduct a large phase 3 clinical study and found that the vaccine is both safe and effective. The vaccine is a 2-dose series given 21 days apart, and it was reported to be 95% effective against COVID-19. In adults older than 65, it was also found to be effective at 94%. And given these numbers, I think a lot of the medical community as well as the scientific community are very elated. At those kind of numbers in terms of effectiveness, it is one of the most effective vaccines we have for any disease out there. The vaccine does provide a ray of hope, a hope that this is the beginning of the end of this terrible pandemic that has affected so many lives. It is important to note that the vaccine will not be widely available until weeks or months down the road for the general population. We need to continue our preventative measures until that time, which does include social distancing and masks for the foreseeable future. In terms of the full criteria and so the selection criteria, that may be better answered by the state. I can tell you that it's due to the logistical considerations, our access to ultra-cold freezers in the area. And given, again, as I mentioned, our vulnerable population, we do have a pretty dense vulnerable population here, given our age and the number of long-term care beds. Additionally, I can say just from the health department standpoint, we have experience with a number of mass vaccination efforts. In 2018 and 2019, we had one of the largest hepatitis A outbreak in the state. And through our efforts, through our vaccination efforts, so through our foot teams, we were able to control that and get past that outbreak. A number of public health officials will continue to recommend that you wear masks and do other preventive measures, such as social distancing. We are striving with any vaccination effort to achieve that herd immunity. There isn't an exact number at this time, but they do expect that at least two-thirds of people need to be vaccinated to get reach that kind of herd immunity. Additionally, the studies does show that it did prevent disease, serious disease, pretty effectively, but not necessarily infection. So those that could be asymptomatic may not necessarily be captured. And as we have seen, asymptomatic individuals can still spread the disease. Now, in terms of the effectiveness of after one dose, again, you need that two doses to be effective, the most effective. And also in terms of longevity, you need to, again, take those two doses. But interim studies does show that even after one dose, it is about 82% effective. First, in terms of storage of where the vaccine is going to be, it's going to be in a secure location. We're going to follow the guidance according to the manufacturers. Obviously, it does require that ultra-cold chain aspect of that. Now, in terms of the administration of the vaccines, that's going to be done in conjunction with these paramedic strike teams, with the National Guard sort of coordinating that, and we will be going to the facilities. Obviously, it's been a large partnership. Again, paramedics, we're going to use what we've done in the past using the regional incident management team structure. As you recall, in terms of when we did these various outreaches and initiatives through the nursing homes, we did the testing, we did the infection control. So we'll be using that same kind of model. In terms of when we found out, it was earlier this week, and since that time, I can tell you there has been a lot of pre-planning that's gone into this, and we have reached out to some of the nursing homes, and we plan to hold and host two or three calls before the launch of this initiative with all the facilities. For this specific pilot mission, the focus, again, will be mainly the nursing home residents as well as staff. So in terms of priority lists, we defer that to what the ACIP and what Florida is putting out there as the 1A priorities. That does include the healthcare professionals as well as long-term care staff and residents. What I can say of the phase three studies, that there wasn't any concerns of that Guillain-Barré similar to the flu. It does work by a different mechanism. I am aware of these anaphylactoid reactions that's been happening in the UK, and I am curious as to what the FDA sort of puts out there in terms of EUA, whether it would be indicated for those with severe anaphylaxis type of reactions. So obviously, what we want to do is try to deliver safely and effectively the vaccine to those willing to take it among the nursing home staff and residents. In terms of the Pinellas strike team, it's going to be, I think we're charged with trying to develop that pilot, and if it's scalable, the other areas of the state can use as well. So I think that's what we're trying to accomplish with this pilot. I would say be patient. We are limited by both the supplies. We follow the federal guidance and as well as the ACIP guidelines. That's the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. We do need to prioritize those at higher risk, again, with the healthcare workers, the long-term care residents, but as we get more vaccines available, it'll be more widely available to the general population. We certainly will communicate that, work with your medical providers to answer any questions you may have and concerns about the vaccine. And if needed, we will continue to work with community partners to do these community vaccination drives if indicated and needed. I think a few months down the road, there is going to be a number of different vaccines out there. Most of them do require the two dose, and it's important to remember that the second dose needs to be exactly the same as the first dose. It is not interchangeable. In terms of tracking, we do have a immunization tracking system in the state of Florida called Florida Shots, and that will be all monitored through that system. Obviously, for anyone with a medical chart, it should be recorded there as well. It'll be recorded in the Florida Shots. We'll put reminders in both their systems, give cards, and we're working, trying to implement an automated reminder as well. Like any vaccine that requires multiple doses, it's important to get both doses for two reasons. Number one, you do have higher effectiveness when you get those dose number two. Additionally, in terms of longevity, you have a better chance of having sustained immunity if you get both doses. the flu virus and the coronavirus are little apples and oranges, and I'm not going to get into the science, but the flu virus has that propensity to mutate a lot faster. That's why we do need that annual vaccine for the flu. The coronavirus is and the vaccine that works against it is more stable since it's targeting one set of protein and that spike protein of the coronavirus. But in terms of transparency, just because the studies have not gone past 3 months, we don't know the exact longevity and how long this vaccine is going to last, and you'll have that immunity. In terms of the long term, I'm hopeful that we could that the immunity will be there for 1 to 2 years, but that is to be determined at this time. Again, I think this is a great opportunity for Pinellas County. I'm thankful for leadership that we were selected as that pilot site. And again, anything that we can do to protect the vulnerable population. And I believe these are the first steps in that right direction.
Well, that was Dr. Yuli Cho. He's the director of the Florida Department of Health in Pinellas County. Pinellas is one of two counties in Florida that has gotten approval for the pilot vaccine. And we're taking your questions. This is Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM. It's 12:17 in the afternoon. And if you'd like to call in and ask a question, it's 813-239-9663. You can also email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. Well, in addition to Pinellas County, another place in the area that is getting the vaccine is Tampa General Hospital. It's one of five hospitals in Florida that's participating in the state's pilot program for the distribution of the coronavirus vaccine. This morning, the first person got the vaccine in Florida. It was a nurse, and it's Vanessa Arroyo was able to get the vaccine less than an hour ago, and we saw that on television. And joining us right now for the perspective about what's going to happen at Tampa General Hospital is Dr. Jason Wilson. He's the medical director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General. Welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint, Dr. Wilson.
Hey, Sean, it's good to be back.
Thanks so much. And I know we just had you on, but this is a new perspective here with the vaccine. The vaccine is in the house, as they say. It's at Tampa General. It's being stored at minus 70 Celsius. So what I want to ask to begin with is who will be the first people that will be getting this vaccine from Tampa General?
Yeah, about 2 to 3 weeks ago, we began to seriously identify frontline staff who would be eligible to receive the first wave of the vaccine. And so that meant thinking about the people who see COVID patients the most. And that includes our emergency department staff, our ICU staff, and the team of people, of course, in the COVID unit, which is now called the GEDI, the Global Emergency Disease Institute. And so thinking about all those people, the doctors, the nurses, the respiratory therapists, the pharmacists, other staff members who interact in those areas, those were identified as our highest priority first wave of individuals who should receive vaccine. And from there, we started to think about how to get to those individuals and ask them if they'd like to receive the vaccine. And over the past week, we've been doing exactly that, reaching out to those folks and asking if they'd like to receive the vaccine. And even now this weekend, starting to schedule them for vaccination.
And one of your bosses, the president of Tampa General Hospital, said at that press conference, he said that Tampa General now has 20,000 doses of hope because this has been a really bleak year. And now that the vaccine, it might not be a panacea, it might not happen right away, but at least I think people are beginning to have some sort of hope that there is a vaccine, that it's being distributed. What are your thoughts on what he said, how he called that?
Yeah, if you go back a year from now, we still didn't even know this virus existed. And to be sitting here, after a really long, hard year to have, seen as much, death and destruction as we've seen from this pandemic, totally change our healthcare system, our economy, our lives. But then to be sitting here and talking about a vaccine in hand within a year, less than a year, is amazing. It's a moon level breakthrough level of science. I would really say the mood was as happy as I've seen it this weekend among the frontline staff, knowing that the vaccine was coming. It's been a pretty exhilarating experience, I would say, to know that's there. There's some hope here for both us and our patients. And when I say, hope for us, it's, hope to be able to take care of these patients safely in this community and to be able to keep on treating people with COVID safely. But then knowing also that some of our patients who are sick, we're going to be able to, vaccinate those types of patients here in the future.
And it won't be just frontline workers at Tampa General that will be getting these first immunizations, is my understanding. You're also shipping it to other local hospitals?
Yeah, that's my understanding. Actually, as we're chatting, you know, news is changing all the time here, Sean. And but that's my understanding here. I'm actually sitting here talking with Tampa General a little bit about that. And so I don't have a lot of details about that, but I'm learning that right now, that we are going to be sending this around to some other hospitals. And, you know, we have those 20,000 doses that John Corris talked about, but we may be moving some of that around to places that need it throughout the Tampa Bay area.
And those 20,000 doses, people might think, okay, well, that's enough for 10,000 people to get inoculated the two times that you need it. But what they're specifically doing, it sounds like, is they want to get 20,000 people inoculated, and then they'll send more in time for them to get the second shot, what is it, in about 3 weeks.
Yeah, so the CDC has been pretty clear about that on the phone calls I've been on, that it's okay to go ahead and try to use what you have available to get as much vaccination out there as possible. And then we've got 3 more weeks here to worry about getting the next round of supply for that second dose that's required.
We're speaking with Dr. Jason Wilson, Medical Director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital, and this is WMNF's Midpoint Monday at 12:22 in the afternoon. So right now, if you're just a member of the public and you're concerned, you'd like to get this vaccine, there's really not anything that you are that's available to you right away. But if you are in a high-risk group, is there a way that you can kind of think about the future and getting reserving a spot in line for the vaccine once it does become available?
Yeah, so what's going to happen is local healthcare leaders, and you saw Yuli Cho just say this to him a moment ago, but the local healthcare leaders and public health experts will begin to think about how much vaccine we have available, how much more is coming as things stabilize a little bit. You know, how do we get past that 1A, 1B, 1C phase the CDC guidelines have issued? And how do we move vaccines safely throughout the community? First emphasizing really the frontline healthcare workers and then long-term care facility residents. The other thing you're going to see here in the next couple of weeks is other vaccines start to come into the emergency use authorization market as well, I think. And that's going to start to help things really start to spread around and move throughout the community as quickly as possible. And I should say, no one wants to restrict vaccine. Look, we all have the same goal in mind right now, and that's to get everyone vaccinated as quickly as possible. Just recognizing that we've got to do, you know, these vaccines for the most high-risk patients and healthcare workers first. And so in terms of, you know, getting information to your healthcare provider or reserving a spot, there's not a formal way quite yet or a systematic way quite yet to reserve a spot. But, you know, as long as you're seeing a healthcare provider, they're going to understand that information. And at some point, they'll be contacted or have a way to kind of start to take their patients and move them into the system for vaccination.
Do we have an idea of about how long that might be?
I don't yet. You know, this is really, we're seeing today the first vaccine, you know, come into the area. But what you can start to kind of play the cards out and look at the dominoes is that the Moderna vaccine is right behind the Pfizer vaccine. So they submitted their information to the FDA about a week after the Pfizer company submitted their information. And so you'd expect that the FDA would again meet with the Vaccines and Biologic Committee, that the CDC's ACIP committee would again meet, and you'd probably see recommendations for that Moderna vaccine to start to move through as well. That's a very similar vaccine that the Pfizer vaccine looks like. And so as more of these vaccines move into the market under emergency use authorizations, you're going to see the ramp up happen more quickly. So, you know, I think you can kind of think about frontline healthcare workers during this holiday period, moving into January, long-term care facilities starting to be vaccinated as well over these next week or so. And then as we get into the new year, hopefully start to see this vaccine move into vulnerable patient populations as well.
And the governor seemed to indicate that the Moderna vaccine might be about 1 week behind, as you said, so it might even get that preliminary approval by the weekend and start to ship, and we might see it next week, as soon as next week. I mean, it's speculation at this point. We don't know for sure what's going to happen.
Yeah, my sense is this feeling of urgency and speed that we've had since Friday, I would, you know, after the EUA, is going to continue on, you know, through the winter months, basically. You're going to see more vaccines moving like this into market. You're going to see some of the vaccines move from emergency use authorization to full approval. Remember, the Pfizer company now has their entire phase 3 study completed, and I've advocated for that from the beginning of this quest for vaccines, is that we should still see completion of phase 3 study studies, and we should demand to see that data for those phase three studies to make sure that it matches the interim analyses that are done that can sometimes lead to these emergency use authorizations. So Pfizer's provided that now, and what's very reassuring is that data looks very good. That data doesn't change anything from the halfway point. It still looks very good. And so, you know, you're going to see this whole game changing rapidly as we keep on moving through, and more and more people will come online who are eligible to receive this vaccine, able to receive this vaccine, given the supplies logistics that we have.
Our guest is Dr. Jason Wilson, Medical Director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital. TGH just received vaccines today, or maybe it was yesterday, but just started distributing them today. The first shots happened about an hour ago. And let's shift briefly from the vaccine itself to the pandemic. And there have been more than 20,000 deaths in Florida, more than 1.1 million positive coronavirus cases in the U.S. The numbers are worse, even 16 million infections, nearly 300,000 deaths. Tell us about how the Tampa Bay area is trending right now. In fact, I as an aside, I just spoke to our general manager here, and he said he drove by a testing site on 22nd Avenue, 22nd Street North in Tampa. And the line is, he said something like five blocks long to get tested. So what do we know right now about the infection rates, hospital capacities in the Tampa Bay area?
Yeah, I can tell you that what we're definitely seeing right now is exactly what we predicted from the Thanksgiving holiday. And, you know, this is something I think that's important, is that for the most part, all the predictions public health experts have made about what's going to happen with this vaccine, with this virus, have come to play. And that's unfortunate, but it's reality. And it's just an echoing that we have to understand the data that public health experts are looking at and making recommendations based on is the best available data that we have. And we've got to think about following those recommendations if we want to get through this pandemic. Even as we roll out a vaccine, we still have a ways to go to get enough people vaccinated. And that means we're going to have to follow public health strategies. And so what we're seeing right now is that the Thanksgiving holiday has brought on a number of new cases. And specifically, and unfortunately, what we're specifically seeing in the hospital setting are older, vulnerable people who are exposed during the Thanksgiving holiday by their family and are now sick with COVID. We have a number of those types of cases in this area. And the lines you're seeing at the testing sites are people who are recognizing that there was a family member who was sick at Thanksgiving and they were all exposed to COVID. And now they're out, you know, to get tested because of that exposure. Fortunately, the county did bring online a couple more testing sites. My understanding also from just talking to patients is that the turnaround times have drastically dropped for testing. And the county testing sites are really, you know, as competitive as some of the private, you know, for pay, you know, consumer testing sites that you're seeing out there. And so this is giving at least, you know, where we've known we need to go since at least last March and April, which is widely available, more rapid testing for the public. While there are lines, that's unfortunate, we are getting close to the fact at least there's access to some type of rapid testing for people. You know, I have heard some pretty positive stories of people going to get tested and having results, you know, within the next couple of hours, if not even sooner. And so that's exactly what we want to see. And hopefully as, you know, these other sites come online, those lines will go down a little bit as well. But that's what we're seeing is a kind of a bounce after the holidays.
Since we're talking about testing, why don't we, if you don't mind, can you lay out the three different types of tests that are available? I think there are three broad categories, what the differences are and what each of them would tell you. So if people are going to get tested, they might be confused about which one they should get.
No, that's a great question. And so when you think about it in terms of testing for the virus itself, so testing, the virus is a RNA virus, and you're going to hear the word RNA a lot because a lot of the vaccines are RNA vaccines or mRNA vaccines. And the virus is an RNA virus. And one of the types of tests we have, sort of the gold standard type of test we have, is what's called a PCR viral test. And that test actually tries to look for a very small amount of viral fragment, actual virus. And then we kind of replicate it in a machine to amplify it up so we can see that signal more easily. And that's called PCR, polymerase chain reaction. And that's the most sensitive test that we have. And that's the one where we think about traditionally the swab that goes way back in the back of the nasopharynx, you know, sort of makes you sneeze or makes your eyes burn a little bit. There are some other ways to get a PCR testing now that have come online since the pandemic started. There are some saliva-based PCR testing. We're seeing those used a lot in athletics and and other types of events where we need to make sure people are negative with the PCR test. And then also with some of the PCR testing now, there is the availability to use some less invasive nasopharyngeal swabs. Then the other type of testing that is also for whether you have a virus right now is antigen testing. Now, that doesn't look at actual genetic sequences of the virus, but it looks for evidence of antigen on the outside of the virus, a protein on the outside of the viral particle. The advantage of the antigen testing is that you can do it more rapidly, you can also do it a little less invasively as well. Sometimes you can do those antigen tests with just the nasal swab. And so both the PCR and the antigen testing both look for a evidence of an acute infection, meaning I have COVID right now. Now, the other type of testing we hear about is a little bit different. That's antibody testing. Antibody testing looks for evidence of whether I did have COVID. It turns out that about 10 days after you've had COVID or symptoms of COVID, most people, over 95% of people, will mount antibodies, a lot of presence of antibodies. And so then you go get an antibody test and you can see those antibodies.
So those are the types of tests. And once someone gets tested, if they get a positive test, then people, hopefully, people will be contact tracing the contacts of those people. How is Florida doing when it comes to contact tracing?
Yeah, so what I'm hearing from patients actually is much more reassuring than what I was hearing in June and July. You know, in June and July, it was a situation where it was virtually impossible because of the sheer just volumes of people who had COVID, and B, not really that meaningful from a public health standpoint, meaning if you've got a high enough prevalence of disease in the population, then essentially everyone is a contact. And so think about a common cold virus. You know, I wouldn't do contact tracing with the common cold virus because both you and I are essentially contacts. We know someone right now with the common cold. It's that endemic in our society. However, once we can bring the overall numbers down a little bit, the positivity numbers down a little bit, and get a little control of these things, then contact tracing becomes much more useful because we could do some containment strategies around contact tracing. And the state, to their credit, it did hire quite a number of contact tracers at the end of the summer, and that with coupling that with stabilization of our numbers thanks to masks and the rollback of the bars in the midsummer, the contact tracing has improved. So I have heard from patients now, which is different than I was hearing this summer, that they were contacted by somebody from the Department of Health, and I know that they're working with businesses and employers as well to do some contact tracing.
Our guest is Dr. Jason Wilson. He's medical director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital, and this is WMNF 88.5 FM. I'm Sean Canaan, and you're listening to Midpoint Monday at 12:34 in the afternoon. I'm going to turn back to the vaccines. Just a reminder to people that today the first of healthcare workers in Florida are getting the vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine for coronavirus, and that's happening at Tampa General Hospital. What can you say about healthcare workers? I think it might be self-explanatory why they're among the first to get it. But for example, I was told that I read on fiercehealthcare.com that in September, a nurses union reported that more than 1,700 U.S. healthcare workers had died from COVID-19. Why is it that they're so vulnerable? I mean, besides the fact that they're just in contact more with these patients.
Sure. So, you know, of course, what you just said, healthcare workers are in contact with these patients all of the time. And so when we go into patient rooms, you know, we're wearing PPE, we're gowning up and donning on all of our equipment to go into those rooms. Early in this pandemic, in some areas, you know, there was a limitation, the amount of PPE that was available. Fortunately, in this area, things have been okay. We had a little period of time where we were conservative about our PPE that we had available just because we were concerned about supply lines. But that's really improved. We've had an adequate amount of PPE. But you have to remember, too, not only are we exposing ourselves while we're in the patient room, we're around each other at the workplace, you know, often in close quarters. And so there's, you know, potential that if you were exposed to a patient in the workplace setting while you're close together, even though you're wearing masks, you know, over a long, long period of time in that workplace setting, you, of course, you know, you do worry about easy transmission, easy spread. And then, of course, it's not surprising that people who work in a workplace, you know, see each other often. And so, you know, in the community, we've seen spread of healthcare workers to healthcare workers. So these are all reasons, you know, just in a specific kind of, you know, workplace scenario as we might see spread there. But I think also more to that is that I think we need some hope for our healthcare workers who've been seeing the devastation and of treating COVID patients or this pandemic on people's lives, you know, for 8 months now. And, you know, I think when you think about, you know, we had an emergency medicine physician in the state of New York who was sort of at the peak of her career, you know, and a medical director of a busy, you know, emergency department who committed suicide in the middle of this pandemic because she saw so much death. And, you know, I think just the knowing and the knowledge of having a vaccine and being able to get a vaccine really relieves a lot of fear, at least for people who are taking care of patients with COVID, and just sort of gives them some hope and some ability to help us push through these last few months of a really dark before the dawn. And so I think that's part of it. And I think also just for the public to know that we're comfortable getting this vaccine is also very helpful. And so I think it's great to see your, you know, frontline healthcare workers lining up and see that as excited we are. It should tell the public something about A, how devastating we actually think this virus is, how scared of this virus we still are, and B, that we're comfortable with the science and comfortable with the vaccine safety.
The images that people might be seeing today of healthcare workers getting inoculated, I think that might be reassuring to people and help them to make that decision.
Yeah, I hope so. And I, you know, it's there's a lot to follow, I know, in terms of the science behind these vaccines, and things have moved very quickly. And, you know, I know there's a lot of disinformation and misinformation out there. But overall, you know, I can tell you that these vaccines were studied, that the Pfizer vaccine specifically, because I've seen the full, you know, phase 3 data set now. And these were studied the same way any other clinical trial would be done, any other vaccine type of study would be done. And now you've gone through, you know, multiple independent experts looking at this information from the FDA and the CDC, and really everybody agreeing that this is appears to be a safe vaccine and appears to be a very efficacious vaccine in ways that we haven't seen before for vaccine efficacy. And, you know, so much so that the risk of COVID outweighs the risk of vaccine so much. It's like driving on I-4 without a seatbelt compared to flying in a commercial, you know, airliner.
Our guest is Dr. Jason Wilson. He's medical director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital. Recently, you posted a New York Times article about the FDA granting emergency authorization of an antibody treatment. You added, we now have two outpatient antibody infusion treatment options at Tampa General, two brands of anti-spike monoclonal antibody for patients with mild, moderate disease outside of a hospital setting. Complicated but promising is what you wrote. What is antibody treatment and how effective is it?
Yeah, great question. So these antibody treatments have been exciting for us to see. It's given us the ability to treat patients who don't need to be in the hospital. And that's the first time throughout this outbreak that we've had some type of therapeutic for people who are not severely ill with COVID. Our other treatment options for patients so far have been for people who require oxygen and need to be in the hospital for treatment. But these monoclonal antibodies, which are basically very similar to the types of antibodies you would mount from a vaccine or that you would mount on your own, except they're synthetic essentially, and they're derived to specifically attack things like the spike protein. We can give those antibodies in an infusion to go after spike protein. And what we've seen from those already, as we give those to patients in our outpatient clinic settings, is a decrease in the returns to the hospital, a decrease in hospitalizations, which is exactly what was shown in the data from both the Eli Lilly company and the Regeneron company. The Regeneron company uses a mixture of two different antibodies. We call it a cocktail, antibody cocktail, and the Eli Lilly one uses one antibody. I don't know if there's a difference yet in terms of, you know, which one of those is better, but they both seem to be decreased number of patients have to come back from the hospital. Anecdotally, patients, you know, have told me that they feel much much better the next day after receiving these vaccines. I'm sorry, these monoclonal antibodies. Now, the only thing with these monoclonal antibodies, they're not for everyone. The way they're designed right now is that they're for higher risk patients who are leaving the emergency department or being seen as an outpatient. And so essentially, you need to probably be a little bit older to really get benefit from these antibodies, or have a number of risk factors, things like high blood pressure and diabetes, or having obesity or other immunocompromised. And those are the patients we're trying to get these antibodies to as quickly as possible. Another thing too is your symptoms for COVID had to start in the last 10 days. So I will say, you know, just like I tell the public that if you're having a stroke, you know, you should come into the hospital as quickly as possible. If you're having a heart attack, you should come in as quickly as possible. If you do have COVID or think you have COVID, you should get tested as quickly as possible and talk with your healthcare provider about that if you are symptomatic and have risk factors, and they could perhaps help you get aligned with antibody treatment.
Our guest is Dr. Jason Wilson, Medical Director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital. We'll have him on for another 3 or 4 minutes, but would you like to take a question from a listener? Is that all right with you?
Yeah, of course.
All right, let's do that. Why don't we take a call from Dylan in Lutz. Hi, Dylan. You're on the air. What would you like to say?
Well, excuse me. You know, we're being asked to trust the FDA and the pharmaceutical companies begging for approval. But what we have to look at is the clinical trials are done by the drug companies, the fox guarding the chicken coop, for instance. The FDA is supposed to regulate the pharma industry, but the FDA is actually paid by the pharmaceutical industries to regulate. So pharma runs the trials, then we're told to trust the findings of those. And there's a lot of good evidence that that's just not true. Dr. Stephen Wizen of the...
Clay, hold on. I'm going to have the doctor answer, but thank you. That's a good question. I appreciate that. So why should we trust the drug companies when they say that they're safe?
I think it's a very fair question. And so let me walk through a little bit. You're right that this is a sponsored trial by a pharmaceutical company. And I will say, you know, even when we have sponsored trials from pharmaceutical companies, the FDA does give them guidelines for what they're going to want to see for approval. And so there is some work together that happens between the FDA and a pharmaceutical company when a trial like this happens. One thing I will say is that there were no studies done by the drug company that were not published or not moving towards transparent data being available, which is not always the case. There are other, you know, drugs that either come to market or never make it to market, where we have trials that were called negative trials and we never get to see those. But we have a positive trial here with the data available to everybody to look at. And it's the only really trial that's been done. It's still ongoing. That's a reassuring sign. You don't have like 5 negative studies here before this comes. The other thing about the FDA as well is, while you're right that there is some relationships between the FDA and the drug companies, they also have a number of independent bodies that do work on their, you know, that sort of keeps them transparent. And so the Vaccines and Biologics Committee is really a group of experts who may not be employed by the FDA, but may be academics and other public health experts at different places who do peer review for journals, who do studies of their own, who have really deep expertise in this area. And so you've seen it go, this set of data go through those groups already. In addition, the CDC's looked at this data themselves as well. They've issued their own opinion just yesterday. On Sunday, they issued their own opinion about the data, and that seems to agree. They could have disagreed if they wanted to. I would say something this public and this with the data being this transparent and available, it does help us relieve some of those concerns. But you're right, and I've advocated from the beginning that I wanted to at least see the phase 3 trial go to completion and have the data remain transparent. In addition, having the FDA act independently of other branches of the government was also important. They need to be able to do the job they normally do, keep the same processes they normally take to review data. And I think, fortunately, maybe some shifts in the political climate, they were able to do that and were able to take a look at this data and take their time and issue a vote that I think is a fair vote.
Well, Dr. Jason Wilson, thanks so much. But before I let you go, is there anything else that you would like people to know about the coronavirus in Tampa Bay, about the new vaccine, anything that people should know about?
Yeah, the vaccine coming is very exciting, and you're going to have a chance to get the vaccine very soon. I'm getting mine tomorrow afternoon. I'm very excited about that. But as we do this and as we ramp up the vaccine distribution throughout this area, it's going to be critically important that we still continue to do those same public health interventions we have to do, which include wearing a mask, washing our hands, and staying distance and staying out of crowded indoor spaces. It's even more critical now because we're so close to the finish line, but it's going to take a while to ramp up the number of people we need to get vaccinated till we could get there. So let's not lose it now. I know we're sick of this virus, but it's still here and it's not sick of us, even though it's the holidays. And we've got to stay with some pretty tight-knit pods, families during these holidays. Otherwise, we're going to see a horrible surge in January, which is even more unfortunate. We have a vaccine right around the corner, you know, coming to this community. So please stay safe out there and follow those public health guidelines.
Well, thank you so much for coming on Midpoint today, Dr. Wilson.
Anytime, Sean. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks so much. Dr. Jason Wilson is the medical director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital. What do you think about what you've heard so far this hour, and what's the best way for the country to move forward through this pandemic? Here's the number to call in, 813-239-9663. You can also email us at dj@wmnf.org. You can text us at 813-433-0885. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa, WMNF.org. It's 12:46 in the afternoon. We're going to take calls the rest of the hour, with the exception of one thing I'm going to tell you about in just a second. But this is Sean Canaan with WMNF's Midpoint Monday, and we're going to take your calls at 813-239-9663. But right now, I'm going to turn to an interview I just did with Charlie Crist, with Congressmember Charlie Crist, a few days ago. Last week, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement conducted a raid on the home of the fired COVID-19 State Dashboards data scientist. In response, Congressmember Charlie Crist released an email statement that was critical of that raid of Rebecca Jones's house. We heard from Rebecca Jones last hour. Now we're going to hear the former Florida governor. And in that email, he wrote, "The guns-drawn FDLE raid on the home of Rebecca Jones was shocking, over the top, and demands a full explanation." I spoke with Congressmember Crist about that and a couple of other topics. So we'll be back to take your calls in just a few minutes. But here is Congressmember Charlie Crist. Congressmember Charlie Crist, thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
It's my pleasure, Sean. Great to be with you always.
On Tuesday, you released an email statement that was very critical of what your understanding was of the raid on the home of Rebecca Jones, the state's former COVID-19 data manager.
Yes.
What were your main concerns about what you saw in that raid?
Well, that it was a guns-drawn raid into her home with her children there. And I'm sure many of your listeners, viewers, saw the video. It's been on MSNBC and CNN the last 24 hours, and it's very disturbing to me. And, you know, if somebody is suspected of doing something wrong and a warrant has been issued, which according to FDLE, a warrant was issued in this case, but this was not some kind of, you know, heinous crime. This was, you know, talking about maybe sending a message that shouldn't have been sent, which she denied she did. And so why they came in with guns drawn when apparently no violence was even suspected here is bizarre to me, to say the least, Sean. I don't understand it.
And even after she was in custody, I guess you would say, she was completely complying, it seemed, they were still concerned that her children were upstairs and maybe her husband, but their guns were still out. Do you have any concern in the fact that there were children involved in this raid?
Oh, absolutely. Of course. Yeah, I think she said she had a young daughter and son that were in the home, that her husband had gone upstairs with the children, I think holding one of them, if I saw her interview correctly last evening. And, you know, to have guns pointed at a child is just shocking. I mean, this is the kind of stuff of nightmares. And I just don't understand why the state would have acted this way. And I think that not only she, but the people of Florida deserve answers as to why such a raid that you would expect in a different country, perhaps, would even occur in Florida. It just doesn't make sense.
And I spoke to a Republican former member of the Judicial Nominating Commission who resigned in part because of this action, and he suggested that possibly the government was trying to intimidate people who might be whistleblowers inside the government of the state. They might want to try to find out who's been communicating with her when they access Rebecca Jones's computers and phones as a way of trying to forbid or intimidate people from coming forward if they have any whistleblowing information. Now, that's speculation, but does that resonate with you at all?
It does resonate with me, and it does sound like that. It sounds like retaliation of a person who wanted to be transparent as it related to what was happening with COVID and the COVID numbers you know, the number of people that were getting it, the number of people that were dying from it, perhaps, and to skew those numbers so that, you know, Floridians wouldn't be as fearful as maybe they otherwise perhaps could be if accurate numbers were being released. And that seems to be at the root of this whole issue. And why you come to somebody's private home with about four or five agents with guns drawn because you want to check and see what her computer shows seems beyond the pale. It is beyond the pale, if that's the rationale. And so I think it's disturbing. And, you know, somebody needs to be held accountable as to why something like this happens to one of our fellow Floridians who was working for the state government at the time, then is fired because they claim she was insubordinate. And I don't know exactly what they mean by that. But, you know, taking her side of the story, it's because she was trying to be honest with the people of Florida, be transparent with the people of Florida, and be honest about what was happening with this virus in our state. Well, that's what you should be doing, being honest, being transparent, and straightforward with the people of Florida. That apparently was her job, and it sounds like she was retaliated against for having tried to do her job.
We're speaking with Congressmember Charlie Crist, a Democrat from St. Petersburg. Representative Crist, you used to be the governor of Florida, and you were a Republican. If you were governor right now, how would you be handling the COVID-19 pandemic for Floridians?
Well, I think much differently than the current governor. I'm very disappointed. And listen, early on, I was very cautious about being a Monday morning quarterback. Because it was new to everybody. It was novel, right, Sean? And so we were in uncharted territory. Well, we've been living with this or not living with this for some, sadly, and God forbid. But, you know, for 9 months now or so, and, you know, at this point in time, other states seem to have gotten the message and understand what's happening. I think President-elect Joe Biden understands what's happening. You need to be transparent. You need to be honest. And your decisions need to be science-based. And, you know, we're not getting that from our current leadership in Tallahassee. And it's very disturbing to me as a Floridian, and particularly as a former governor. You know, there are easy ways to deal with this. It's called being honest, being transparent, leading with courage, and telling people that they ought to wear a mask, they ought to social distance, do things that are appropriate to minimize the effect of the virus on our fellow Floridians and our fellow Americans, for that matter.
Well, let me turn to the response in Congress about a COVID-19 relief bill. The House has already passed two bills since the first one that actually passed the Senate and got signed by the president.
Yeah.
But now, at the end of the session, Congress is trying to work in a last-minute COVID-19 relief bill that might be palatable to both the Senate and to the president. What do you think will be included in that COVID-19 bill?
Well, you know, I'm optimistic. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia has been very forthright on this issue. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, has had the same posture. They look like they're talking about a number that is similar, around $900 billion. But that would just be another step. And then President-elect Joe Biden has said, you know, that sounds like a good beginning, but it's not the end. You know, once I get sworn in on January 20th, President-elect Biden, I mean, that we'll have another opportunity to continue to fight this virus, do things that are responsible, make sure that people get payments that they need and deserve to keep their home, to make sure that they can pay their bills, things of that nature. Because a lot of people are suffering because of this virus, not only physically, but economically.
Congressmember Charlie Crist, if you don't mind, if you have one more minute, I want to ask you about Cuba. The Trump administration took away some of the freedoms for Americans to travel to Cuba that had been enacted during the Obama administration. What do you think will happen with the Biden administration? Do you think that Biden will be open to restoring some of those freedoms for Americans and to starting to repair the relations with Cuba?
I think that's a good possibility. You know, President-elect Biden's an enlightened man. Obviously, he served as vice president to Barack Obama. And when they had more free engagement with the island, you know, being able to show people, you know, what freedom is like, what capitalism can do in a positive way. And I had the opportunity to visit the island not long ago in the past year. And there was much capitalism that had broken out, still concerns, obviously, with how people are being treated. But, you know, we've had this policy over 50 years of no engagement, and it's gotten us nowhere. And more importantly, it's gotten the people of Cuba nowhere. And I don't think a head in the sand approach is very smart. I think exposing people to what freedom is like, what reasonable capitalism is like, is a positive step. And so I would anticipate that the Biden administration would move in that direction again.
Well, Congressmember Charlie Crist, thank you so much for coming on WMNF today.
Sean, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much and happy holidays to you and your listeners.
Thank you. You too. Well, that was St. Petersburg area Congressmember Charlie Crist. I spoke to him late last week. You can watch this interview. It's on our website right now. It's WMNF.org. What do you think about some of the things you heard from him, especially about the raid on Rebecca Jones's house? If you'd like to join the conversation, we have some people on the line that we're going to go to right now. But if you'd like to join the queue, 813-239-9663. You can also email us at dj@WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. It's 12:56 in the afternoon, and this is Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm going to read an email from Al, and he says, and this is about the raid and DeSantis's characterization of the as not being a raid. He said, it's political, plain and simple. No differences between these actions on the raid and what happened to Manafort or Stone. It's just theater, says Al. And I will go now to Michael in St. Petersburg. Michael, thanks so much for holding. What would you like to say?
I already talked to Rob about the Gestapo SS on Rebecca Jones, so I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the vaccine.
So what number was that?
I used to make medicine. It's very hard. It takes a long time. There's a lot of trials. There's lots of testing. Years. And they got to refine it. They make changes, and then they test again. I don't trust this new vaccine. I think anybody who does is loony. They're trying to rush something through that just hasn't been properly vetted.
Great. I appreciate the thoughts. Thanks so much, Michael. Anything else?
No. Great. I said my piece.
I appreciate it. Thanks for that. 813-239-9663. If you'd like to join the conversation, will you get the vaccine when it's available to the general public? Give us a call and let us know. We have Steve in Tampa on the line. Hi, Steve. What would you like to say?
Hi, Sean.
Hi.
Appreciate your show.
Thanks.
And thanks for Charlie being a good governor, in my opinion. I would like to find out if somebody get a shot, then you can still infect people when you are on COVID-19 patients?
Yeah, so I think...
Not so.
You know, I wish I knew the definitive answer, but here's my understanding of it, and please check me on this. I think it's possible that you can still infect someone if you get the inoculation, because what the inoculation does is it makes your body create proteins that will have your body think that it's being infected, so it'll produce a response, an immune response to the vaccine. Sorry, immune response to the coronavirus. So if you actually do get the coronavirus, it helps your body fight it off, but I think you might still be able to infect other people even though you've been vaccinated. That's my understanding. They're recommending that people, once they're vaccinated, still wear masks. So that's another indication to me that you might be able to still infect other people once you're vaccinated. I hope that answers your question, but please look it up and double check, and maybe I'll even double check and let people know afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Because nobody's talking about that, basically. I never heard anybody to saying, yeah, well, you still can infecting people or not, or what's going on. Other things I would like to add to the raid kind of thing, I was thinking about which one is better, communism or fascism, you know? So... Because it's, I don't know, it's just weird things happening in this country right now, and it's very, very sad.
All right, thank you for those thoughts, Steve. I appreciate that. I hope I answered your question well and correctly about the vaccine. Rob in Lutz, you have about 15 seconds to make your point, if you can do that. Do you think you can do that?
Yes.
All right, quickly, please.
Thank you so much for Dr. Jason Wilson's interview again. WNF has come through with flying colors and community service. God bless you, sir. Thank you so much.
All right, Rob, thanks so much, and I appreciate everyone who called in, and thanks to everyone who has emailed and also for called, of course. Thank you to DT and Frank Knox for help on the show today. Frank was answering your phones. I'm Sean Canaan. Tomorrow at noon, your hero, Mark Bureau, will host Midpoint Tuesday. And before I sign off completely, let me read this Email from Lou in Plant City, who says, it was great to hear the joy in Dr. Wilson's voice. I know the crisis has taken a huge toll on the medical community. It helped bring hope to us all. So thank you for that comment, Lou in Plant City. Hey, next up is Latino 54. That's coming up after NPR headlines on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Thanks so much for listening. Please wear a mask. Keep your distance from people. Gather with people who live in your household. And hopefully we'll all see you next time as well. Everyone will be safe. Thanks for listening.
We're more than sand and the seashore. We're more than